Well, thank you for coming. As you know, the topic of our discussion this morning is the Federal Reporter Shield. It's a very hot topic. It's a very timely topic. Every so often, the idea of a Federal Reporter Shield law comes up, but it seems to have gained a head of steam recently. The House has passed a bill. The Senate is currently considering a bill. And there's been a flurry of press coverage and editorials and statements of position from the administration on it lately. So let me just give you a quick overview of some of the arguments pro and con, and then we'll go to our panelists. Proponents of the legislation argue that it's needed because subpoenas to reporters are on the rise, and that increasing subpoenas is chilling legitimate journalism. They point to several recent high-profile cases, including the Valerie Plame investigation, the Belco steroids investigation, the Hatfield anthrax investigation, the Wenho Lee case, and others. They point out that many states already have similar legislation, and they argue that those state laws have not impeded law enforcement. They also note that the legislation attempts to codify procedures that DOJ already imposes on itself, and so they ask, what's the big deal? The legislation's opponents dispute that there is any need for the legislation. They note that leaks on all types of topics currently occur, regardless of the absence of Federal Shield legislation. They note that DOJ's internal guidelines already provide many of the protections the legislation would codify. With respect to the particular legislation pending before Congress, they argue, among other things, that it would damage national security by making it harder to investigate leaks and, in fact, encouraging leaks of classified information. Now, the administration is very strongly opposed to the bill, and the president has even threatened to veto it. I looked on the web this morning and found letters from the DNI, the Attorney General, the Secretaries of Treasury, Energy, Homeland Security, and Defense, all opposing the legislation. And so this gives you an idea of how high a priority this is for the administration to defeat the legislation and the prominence the legislation has recently gained. So let's turn to the panelists. I'm going to introduce them in the order in which they're going to speak. Lee Levine is one of the leading experts on this topic and has been an outspoken proponent of Federal Shield legislation. He's a founding partner of Levine, Sullivan, Koch, and Schultz, and has represented media clients on a range of First Amendment-related matters for the last 25 years. Of particular note today, he's represented several journalists who have been subpoenaed to testify in grand jury, criminal, and civil proceedings, including the Scooter Libby prosecution and the Hatfield investigation. He's also written extensively on these issues and has testified in both houses of Congress in support of the Federal Shield law. Drew Oreska also brings real-world experience to this panel, but from the opposite perspective. Drew is currently a partner at King & Spalding's New York office, handling a variety of government investigations. He has extensive experience as a prosecutor. He was an ADA for 4 years in Manhattan. He then went on to the Department of Justice, working in the Deputy Attorney General's office, and then as Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney in the Eastern District of New York. In his capacity as Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney, he would have reviewed any request to subpoena reporters that might have come up from AUSAs in that office. And at DOJ also, the Deputy Attorney General's office is responsible for reviewing requests from U.S. Attorney's offices to subpoena reporters, and so he's seen this issue from the DOJ angle. Professor Lillian Bevere is a leading expert on the First Amendment in the Legal Academy. She's the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor at the University of Virginia Law School, where she teaches courses including freedom of speech and press. She's spoken frequently and published widely on First Amendment issues, most notably including a 2006 article entitled "The Journalist Privilege, a Skeptic's View." So that should give you an idea of her perspective on this issue. Finally, Eric Jaffe brings another supportive voice to the notion of Federal Shield legislation. Eric is a Supreme Court litigator in private practice and has been involved in a number of First Amendment-related cases involving campaign finance, compelled speech, commercial speech, judicial campaign speech, freedom of association, and the list goes on. He has also written extensively on First Amendment issues ranging from campaign finance to judicial election speech to the First Amendment implications of the securities laws. And so he brings another constitutional law expertise to the panel. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I also have some background in this topic. When I was at DOJ, I testified against the bill, and I also debated Lee on the subject of the legislation on TV after I left DOJ, but I promise that for today's purposes, I'm going to remain the neutral moderator. So we're going to start with the panelists, each taking about 5 minutes. We may do a little bit of rebuttal if that seems necessary, and then I'll open it up for questions. So, Lee, let's start with you.
The real question, I think, that ought to set off this discussion is why now? Why is this legislation now before Congress? Why has it gotten up this head of steam that Rachel referred to? And I perhaps can provide a bit of background on that. Simply put, the world in which journalists live has changed dramatically in the last 5 years. The 30 or so years before that, it was highly unusual for any journalist to be subpoenaed to reveal the identities of confidential sources in a federal proceeding. It almost never happened, there were virtually no examples of journalists being held in contempt for refusing to identify confidential sources in federal courts. It just wasn't a problem. Since 2001, however, for a variety of reasons we can perhaps get into, the world has simply changed. In the last 5 years, 4 reporters have gone to jail for refusing to provide compelled testimony about confidential sources or their news gathering activities. More than a dozen have been held in contempt by federal courts. In one case, massive fines and jail time were avoided only because, in a civil case under the Privacy Act, the Wenholy case, only because the employers of the reporters collectively ponied up $750,000 to pay off the subpoenaing reporters so that the plaintiff, so that the journalists could keep their promises of confidentiality of their sources. And most recently, in another Privacy Act case brought by Stephen Hatfield, the person identified by Attorney General Ashcroft as a person of interest in the anthrax investigation, a reporter for USA Today was held in contempt, escalating fines starting at $500 a day and escalating to $5,000 a day were imposed on her. She was precluded by court order from accepting reimbursement for those fines from her employer, her family, her friends, or anybody else who might try to help her with that. And that decision is now on appeal to the D.C. Circuit, which has ordered expedited briefing, and there'll be a hearing in the D.C. Circuit on that on May 9th. The courts, as my description of what happened to Tony Losi in the Hatfield case suggests, have just simply changed their view from what it used to be with respect to whether or not the First Amendment or the common law includes a reporter's privilege, at least of some dimension. Several courts have held that there is no privilege at all in the grand jury context. Several courts have held that there is no privilege in most criminal cases. And several courts have held that although there might be a privilege in the civil context or is a privilege in the civil context, they've narrowed the traditional First Amendment test such that it's proven to be an effective protection for reporters. I can tell you that from my own experience, I've been practicing in the media law / First Amendment area for almost 30 years, and up until about 5 years ago, I would say that if I had a reporter's privilege case once every 3 or 4 years, that would be a lot. Now I spend upwards of 75% of my time representing reporters who have been subpoenaed to reveal the identities of confidential sources, or negotiating with the Department of Justice under the DOJ guidelines about prospective subpoenas of my clients to reveal their confidential sources. So then the next question, of course, is should there be a legislative solution to this problem? From the press's perspective, the answer is obviously yes, because the courts, which for the 35 years after Brandsburg versus Hayes was decided back in the early 70s, had fashioned a First Amendment and or common law privilege to protect journalists in most circumstances, have simply stopped doing that. Second question in that regard, though, is there a problem? Well, you can look at it from two perspectives. One is the numbers of reporters that have now been subpoenaed and held in contempt and put in jail and that sort of thing. The other perspective, of course, is will the absence of a privilege have any noticeable impact or any real-world impact on the ability of the press to report to the public about matters of public concern? And one byproduct of what's happened over the last 5 years is that we've actually developed, I think, a fairly impressive and I would say irrefutable litigation record based on the testimony of these reporters in actual cases, of examples of their own reporting, how they go about doing their own reporting, and the impact that this would have on their ability, no privilege would have on their ability to do their jobs. There are, in the Wenho Lee case, in the Hatfield case, in the Plame investigation, affidavit after affidavit, deposition testimony after deposition testimony of reporters making the case that they simply could not do their jobs if, in appropriate circumstances, they were not permitted to or could not promise confidentiality with any confidence to their sources. And you can go through the list of stories that most people would concede were of public importance that relied heavily on confidential sources, and logic tells you would not be able to have been written without them, starting most recently with the Walter Reed story that the Washington Post broke, major facets of the Enron story, the Abu Ghraib story, the Balco investigation into steroids in baseball. The list goes on and on. The empirical case, if you want to call it that, I think, though, is properly bolstered by the analytical case. And I don't want to steal Eric's thunder, and I'll let him talk about this in more detail. But it seems to me, and this is the argument from an analytical perspective that supporters of the Shield Law have tried to make, is that the notion of protecting a source's right to remain anonymous, which is what this is really at bottom all about, is inherent in any reasonable conception of the freedom of the press. I would commend to all of you Justice Thomas's concurring opinion in the McIntyre versus Ohio elections case, an anonymous speech case arising in the context of election law. And Justice Thomas traces in that opinion quite persuasively the notion that the fundamental place of the ability of people to speak anonymously as being protected by the First Amendment comes from the experience of the colonial press. The printers of that day, the people who are analogous to the publishers of that time, were regularly, or at least more than occasionally, subpoenaed or brought before the Continental Congress or other governmental bodies and asked to divulge the identities of the people who were writing in their publications under pseudonyms, like Publius, for instance. It was very much the sense of the Continental Congress, as Justice Thomas traces, to push back against those efforts on the very reason that the freedom of the press means that printers, publishers, journalists have the right to keep the anonymity of speakers inviolate. So it seems to me that that is a founding principle of what we mean by freedom of the press, and all we're really doing here in the Shield Law is extending that protection in some meaningful fashion to people who want to speak about public affairs anonymously and do it through the vehicle of the press.
I'd like to start out by pointing out, you know, I've been a prosecutor in both the state and federal systems. I'm a defense lawyer now. And I think, drawing on my government experience, I think it's fair to say there's actually broad areas of agreement between those who are proposing the Shield legislation and the government, who has made very clear, as Rachel pointed out, that they oppose the exact same legislation. Among those areas of agreement, importantly, is respect for both the First Amendment and the important place that news gathering takes in our society. It is to some extent a constitutional place, but I think that when we're talking about the proposed shield legislation, it's really not constitutional, it's really a statutory issue. And the issue put directly that we're trying to decide doesn't have to do so much with the general categories that Lee was describing as who should be making the decisions when two important societal values and two legal principles collide. And one is, yes, there should be a broad scope of freedom for news gathering. And it can be that over-aggressive government tactics can impinge news gathering to such an extent that it does interfere with the free press. But on the other side of the equation, the government is also the executive branch is charged with enforcing the laws. And criminal prosecutions specifically have often, probably most often, been the focus of this conflict. Obviously, there are also civil cases as well, as Lee pointed out, but it appears with greater sharpness in the criminal cases. So in the cases where there is a valid government interest in enforcing criminal law versus where there is a valid news gathering interest in gathering confidential information, who's supposed to be making the decision? I'd like to put to aside for a second the issue of abusive government investigations. There are some that happens. Governments, prosecutors issue subpoenas they shouldn't issue, embark down investigative routes they shouldn't embark on. The Duke LaCrosse case is a glaring example, but it's hardly the only one. I think that kind of special case, there are safeguards in place to deal with that, both the state and federal level. Sometimes they don't work as quickly as we might like, and real damage is done, but the judicial system does eventually handle them. The harder case is the one we're talking about, where the two very valid interests at stake. And the question is, who's going to decide? Is it going to be the executive, which is what it is now in the federal system? You have an elaborate series of reviews and tests for the government, the Justice Department, to decide whether or not to issue a subpoena to a news person, a news organization. Or, as the proposed SHIELD legislation would suggest, should it be the courts in the first instance? The way a subpoena will usually come up as it stands now in the absence of the SHIELD legislation is that a subpoena will issue eventually after running through the long set of tests and traps of the Justice Department, and it will come in front of a judge. But the standard the judge will apply is extremely deferential to the government, to the executive. And as I'm sure Lee would tell you, usually the decision has been to allow the government to get its information, sometimes at the cost of contempt and all the associated problems that brings up. So when we're talking about this issue, what we're really trying to strike is the balance between executive and judicial power. In reviewing the proposed legislation, I also found it an amusing side note that there's nothing said about congressional subpoenas, so I assume that they would be free of this restriction if that were to be enacted. The other issue that comes up from a practical perspective, when you review the proposed legislation and all of the other ideas that have been floated since the days of Brandsburg versus Hayes on how a journalist privilege is to be enforced, is what's the subject matter that's going to be covered and who's the person who's going to be covered. Just a few notes on that. I mean, I think this, in fact, is difficult to apply. I know we have many, many state analogs that have tried to apply that coverage in different ways. As a practical matter, there really are just not that many state cases on this topic, or at least not that many that have resulted in printed decisions. I was a state prosecutor earlier in my career, and in my experience, this just did not come up very often at the state level, perhaps because the rules are all settled there. But it has fallen to the federal sphere to make what is a messy bit of case law that is difficult to apply and has left everybody in a bit of a quandary as to exactly whether there is a privilege, to what extent it applies. And I think that it would be genuinely beneficial to have some clarity from somewhere, ideally from Congress, saying exactly what the law is. But it's hard to define exactly who it would apply to. Often, it's not the quintessential case. I mean, the quintessential case which proponents of the law have proposed, as I understand it, is a whistleblower from within the government or knowledge of government wrongdoing calls up a reporter for a mainstream media publication and says, "I'll tell you all about this government corruption problem, but you got to keep my identity secret, otherwise I'll be hung out to dry." But it comes up in a lot of other circumstances, too. It can come up because somebody says they want to be a journalist or want to write a book, and they're just collecting information for that. It can come up because somebody keeps a blog. It can come up based on, an internal newsletter at a company. all of those persons could conceivably under the legislation claim that privilege. Similarly, as I understand it, at least in the Senate bill, the privilege would extend to companies and parent companies of news gathering organizations. So, for instance, can General Electric or Viacom resist a government subpoena saying, well, you know, we have part of our organization engaged in news gathering. We assert that the subject of this subpoena goes to that news gathering, and we'll be the judge of that, and you, government, have to overcome the hurdles imposed by this legislation in order to come after us, rather than having the burden be the reverse, the burden essentially on the one trying to quash the subpoena. So those are some of the practical aspects that come up when I look at this and try to put my government hat back on to see how it would actually be enforced in the real world. I should spend just a second if I have a minute.
1 minute. 1 minute.
I just want to spend 1 minute to talk about what happens in the Justice Department when one of these requests comes up. I mean, the typical situation, it comes up out of the U.S. Attorney's Office. It has to be thought up in the first place by the line assistant who's working on the case, who then writes a memo, and that has got to be approved by the U.S. Attorney. In the office where I worked in the Eastern District of New York, that itself was a multi-step process requiring approval by the Chief of the Criminal Division, Chief Assistant, the United States Attorney herself. Then it goes to the main justice, where it's reviewed by the by a unit within the criminal division, and therefore comes under the purview of the head of the criminal division himself, or herself in, right now. And it also goes up through the main leadership line, through the Deputy Attorney General and the Attorney General. Now, I know that sounds like a lot of steps and a lot of bureaucracy, and it is. The process can be quite cumbersome. There is a juncture at each point where people can say either this is not a good idea, or even if it is a good idea, the game here is not worth the candle. We are a political body, the executive branch, and we will pay a political price for this, even if in the world of absolute benefits we'd really love to be able to pursue this criminal investigation. The Justice Department sometimes, some might say often, decides this isn't worth it. Now, there is quite a bit of informal negotiation that exists right now between the government, which doesn't want push to come to shove, and the reporters, who don't either. And there is a good bit of voluntary information sharing. And maybe that's the way it ought to work. And maybe that contradicts my idea that it would be good to have clarity, because in that ambiguity, things do roughly, unfairly, sporadically somehow tend to get worked out, except in the extreme cases that Lee has talked about.
Remember that I'm from the Academy, and I'm going to ask you to step back a little bit to think not so much about this particular law, why this particular time, what the practice is, but really to look a little bit more carefully at the underlying sort of theoretical basis, if you will, of the press's claim. In a certain sense, you got to recognize that if the press before it, who can be against it? I think principally the people who can be against it, in addition to the president, are professors with tenure. I think the press ought not to be entitled to any sort of privilege to refuse to divulge the identities of their confidential sources in the context of grand jury inquiries or other truth-seeking procedures. And I have several reasons for this. But today I'm going to talk about a kind of empirical challenge to the case that supporters for the privilege make. In fact, I think the arguments in support of the privilege rest on exceptionally weak empirical foundations at their foundation. I accept the empirical premise that an inverse relationship exists between the amount of information that will be disclosed only on the promise of confidentiality, and on the one hand, and the fear that the confidential relationship will be breached on the other. The less likely the guarantee that a confidence will be respected, the less information will be disclosed in confidence. Conversely, the more likely it is that a confidence will be respected, the more information is likely to be disclosed. But the inferences that the press draws from this common sense empirical premise are wildly overblown and extravagant. They apparently assume that with the journalist privilege, we will live in a nirvana of a perfectly informed public, whereas without it, we have endured catastrophe. The ability of reporters to gather news has been significantly and devastatingly impaired.
No matter how often or how confidently the press advocates make this claim, the extreme consequences that they envision have surely not eventuated, and in any event, the privilege they demand greatly exceeds anything that might actually be necessary to keep information flowing freely, which is something I think we all want. Remember, the press has never enjoyed the privilege that it now wants Congress to enact at the federal level. Still, I think the fact is that we're simply awash in indeterminacy about the impact that recognizing or not a reporter's privilege would actually have. We don't really know what confidential sources think, nor do we know what confidential sources think, nor do we know what they care about when they ask for assurances of confidentiality. We know that a lot of what we learn in the press comes from confidential sources, but we don't really know how much of that information is from sources who would not have disclosed it without the promise of confidentiality, unreliable as that promise has always been. We know, or think we know, that a source who values anonymity may be less likely to disclose information in confidence if he genuinely fears disclosure of his identity in a grand jury proceeding, but we don't know how much sources value their anonymity, nor do we know what kind of or how much information has actually been withheld on account of our failure to date to enact a federal privilege. Oh, we're swamped in confident assertions by journalists, most commentators, and some judges about how desperate is their need to be able to guarantee confidentiality and how dire will be the consequences to the flow of information if the judiciary will not honor their promises. In the context of particular debates about whether a privilege should be recognized in particular situations, journalists often declare unequivocally that their sources will dry up if they cannot be guaranteed confidentiality. Their claims are apocalyptic indeed, but given, again, the fact that they have never enjoyed a federal privilege, their gloomy predictions surely are needlessly dire. Privilege advocates and those who are persuaded by them have in common a shared confidence that the public receives better information about government when the press publishes information without being required or even expected to attribute its source than it would receive if attribution were required or expected. But we should remember that there's a neglected downside to the quality of information that the public receives when the press relies on confidential sources as much as it does today. Most importantly, when the consumers of the information that the press provides do not know its source, we are completely dependent on the press's assessment and implicit guarantee of the source's reliability, trustworthiness, and appropriate motivation. There are lots of reasons for people to give information to the press in exchange for promises of confidentiality, and privilege advocates would have us forget that not every source acts from either pure or wholly disinterested motives. Not every source lacks political biases. Not every source is truthful. Not every source has the kind of genuine insight that would render his view of events reliable or even accurate in fact. The press insists that we must trust reporters and editors to assess the dependability of their confidential sources. They imply that we don't need to know who has provided the information they report, nor ought we to insist on assessing for ourselves the quality of the information they provide. And the more journalists are able to protect the identity of their sources, the less opportunity we have to judge for ourselves whether the information the press reports is biased or trustworthy, and whether the sources providing it are genuine insiders who are truly knowledgeable or peripheral players likely to be relatively ignorant. Another note, somewhat more to the point of today's discussion, with respect to the quality of information that the press provides and its supposed relationship to the privilege of confidentiality. The press implicitly claims that when journalists are able to protect their sources, they are then able to gather and report information that is full, complete, and trustworthy. To quote from a New York Times editorial, "Inside sources trust reporters to protect their identities so that they can reveal more than the official line. Without that agreement and that trust between reporter and source, the real news simply dries up, and the whole truth steadily recedes behind a wall of image-mongering, denial, and even outright lies." The Times editors seem to be, inadvertently perhaps, suggesting that journalists are wholly dependent on confidential sources for the information that they gather and report. It cannot be true that confidential sources represent journalists' only means of penetrating the wall of image mongering. Less inadvertently, the Time editors seem to be suggesting that either the news will consist solely of image mongering, denial, and outright lies, or it will be real and consist of the whole truth. Even allowing for editorial hyperbole, the suggestion seems to me to be absurd. Whether or not the press is granted a privilege of confidentiality, and whether or not the privilege is absolute or qualified, the press will continue to provide information, they will continue to rely on confidential sources, and the information they provide about government will inevitably be partial. The press will never report the whole truth, it will never paint the complete picture. No matter how diligent and persevering they are in their news-gathering activities, no matter how forthcoming the confidential sources on which they rely, journalists cannot possibly learn everything about the issues they cover. In addition, they will inevitably disclose only a portion of the incomplete knowledge that they do possess. Moreover, who is to say, and how can it be known, even were the legal system to grant them an absolute privilege of confidentiality, that what they do know and do publish is enough of the truth to represent a reliable snapshot of the whole picture? Who besides themselves can assess the possible bias, reliability, the disinterestedness of their sources? And who besides themselves is to judge whether the information they choose to disclose is, after all, the most relevant, the least misleading part? What I'm saying is this, to the extent that the press portrays the stakes with respect to the reporter's privilege as representing a choice between having news that consists of complete and reliable information, on the one hand, or having news that is incomplete, the product merely of image mongering, on the other, the portrait is misleading in the extreme. But, as I say, if the press is for it, who can be against it?
Well, I come at this from a very different perspective. I come at this not as someone who represents the press. I don't. Not as someone who has ever served in the executive branch. I haven't and probably never will. So I'm not worried about what I say ruining my chances. I come at this strictly as a First Amendment litigator who has some perhaps irrational faith in the insight that the First Amendment provided, which is that more information is good. If it's freely given, that the government should keep its hands off of the flow of information as much as possible within certain obvious constraints, like where the nukes are and what the code is, and that when we're talking on the margins, which is what I actually think we are talking, I agree with Andrew entirely that we're talking about the margins here, we should lean institutionally as a country, we should lean in favor of the First Amendment side of that fight. Because that's why it's there. It's there because the government doesn't need help in leaning its way. It always leans its way. We need help in checking the government. And I think that that's what this privilege would do. A couple of small things. I think as Lee indicated, I view this as nothing more than a special case of the anonymous speech doctrine. No different than the handbills in McIntyre, or quite frankly, the attempts at anonymous speech in the campaign finance context, which, you know, haven't been going so well, but that I oppose regularly. I think you should be able to engage in anonymous political speech, anonymous public interest speech, all sorts of anonymous speech based on both the intuition and the experience that people who want anonymity usually have a pretty good reason for wanting it, that they are afraid of something. And we can quibble about how afraid do they have to be. Does it have to be a well-founded fear or an irrational fear? But people who seek anonymity are usually worried and reluctant to talk. Now, I agree with Lillian. I don't think every single person who asked for anonymity would suddenly dive into a hole if it was denied to them. But on the margins, and I think perhaps Lillian started out agreeing with this general principle, it pushes you in one direction. You get less when you take away the prospect or the carrot of anonymity. So I would view this both from the constitutional perspective of anonymous speech as a valuable constitutional practice that should be defended, plus from the practical matter that it will get us more concrete information about things going on than we would otherwise have if no one had anonymity, or if anonymity was a flimsier protection than it already is. Now, so where does that bring us in terms of this bill. As far as I can tell reading the bill, it does precious little more than the DOJ guidelines themselves do, and in some ways has bigger loopholes than the DOJ guidelines seem to have. So it doesn't provide significantly greater a substantive hurdle to forcing disclosure or to getting the information that you want than the DOJ guidelines, if faithfully enforced, would in fact provide. But what it does do is precisely what Andy says, is it changes the decision maker. It changes who makes the judgment call and who enforces that judgment call. Right now, DOJ, the executive branch, sets their own guidelines. There's no court, there's no Congress forcing them to set those guidelines. And then they interpret and apply those guidelines as they will. And I assume, for purposes of all of this, that they do so in good faith, which is not to say that they don't have an institutional bias. Of course they do. They have an institutional bias of getting the information. These are self-imposed checks that can be interpreted narrowly, interpreted broadly, interpreted fairly. And one can count on the DOJ to interpret them narrowly if there's some information they want at that moment. That's just the way government works. I don't think I'm maligning anyone in the DOJ by saying that. In fact, I think you see behavior of this sort from people who in their private lives might feel this is a bad idea, but in their institutional role as being faithful to the institution that they have agreed to serve, feel that they have to push the line. You see this in executive privilege fights. You see this in Ted Olson becoming Solicitor General and advocating for campaign finance laws that he has decried in his private life. You see this all the time, that being part of the institution of government drives you to stop, to try to limit the checks on your ability to do what you think is public service. This shifts that and says and allows the primary decision maker, Congress, to say, here's the line we're going to draw, and then allows the secondary decision maker, the courts, to enforce that line rather than simply to defer to the DOJ. And I think that having those two branches effectively check the institutional concerns of an executive branch that wants to extract information for executive interests is a valuable thing in our system of checks and balances. Therefore, I think it's good. Even if it's not substantively different on paper, I think it's valuable for Congress to step in and put this down as a law that is not subject to the whims of executive branch politics, and to have the judiciary be given permission to enforce these things, which they don't have right now. They can't, of course, enforce the DOJ guidelines. They just defer. And they certainly wouldn't substitute their own interpretation of those guidelines for that of the DOJ itself. So I think it's valuable to have the court play that role of checking and enforcing what we have ultimately decided is the proper balance between the government's right to know and the court's right to get everyone's information on the one hand, and the interest in encouraging disclosure of information that might not otherwise come to light in the absence of anonymity. That being said, I guess the only thing I would say regarding Professor Revere is I'm not the press. I don't advocate for the press. In fact, I don't think the press has any special privileges in this regard. I would count bloggers in what I would think of as the press for these purposes. I would count the individual handbiller who goes to Kinko's to get the handbill printed up for these purposes. I would count all of these folks. Pardon? Occasionally. They're a little fringe-ish. But they still do it, and I would give them the same precise protection that I would give to the mainstream media, if you will. This is not about the whining of Time Warner. I couldn't care less about the whining of Time Warner. This is about getting the information out from multiple and varied sources. Will that information be perfect? No. Will it be incomplete? Of course. Will it be less incomplete than if we don't give confidentiality? I think the answer to that is similarly, of course it will. We will get more information. It will still not be perfect. It will still have its own biases. It will still make you suspicious when you see the anonymous source said X. But we are not sheep. We are educated, intelligent citizens who should be able to read the fact that anonymous source said Obama's a bum and realize that that anonymous source may not like Obama. And similarly, when they say that about the DOJ or the DOT or the Department of Energy. So I would have more faith in the people, which is what the lesson I take from the First Amendment, and let the information come out there even without a name on it, where the person speaking freely chooses and desires to remain anonymous. Yes.
It's about something that Eric was alluding to, which is what as a practical matter would happen under what happens now or would happen under the mechanics in court as imagined by the bill. The difference is it's not just a matter of who decides. It certainly is that, who decides in the Justice Department versus whether you're having a federal district judge decide whether to apply, whether to enforce a subpoena. Currently what happens is if it goes through the whole process within the Department of Justice, subpoena issues, reporter challenges it, makes a motion to quash, the burden is on the movement, the reporter, the media organization in that point. But the way the scale is tilted is it's very much in favor of the government. The government has very little showing to make in response to that motion to quash in order to get the district court to enforce it. Under the legislation as imagined, the burden shifts quite considerably. In fact, under different versions, it can get to be pretty high in terms of what the government has to show in order to show the kind of compelling interest that so the district judge will enforce the subpoena. As a practical matter, what that means is that in a criminal or national security investigation, the government has to reveal a lot of its case in public to prove that to a judge. The government has to do that in other contexts as well. And for instance, in a search warrant application, the government has to tell a judge an awful lot about what its case is, why there is likely to be information relevant to the investigation found in that specific place. But search warrant applications are ex parte. Whereas here, the government would have to reveal a lot more about its case than it would be comfortable doing, and that would be very chilling on government investigations. We can decide as a society that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that would be the practical effect. And then one other practical point is, within the DOJ, Eric is correct. You know, I have served in the executive branch, and I have seen the process work. Eric is correct that there is, to some extent, institutional inertia that pushes towards prosecution, but there's a lot of force pushing back the other way on the side of, you want to call it policy, prudence, crass politics, but there's a lot of energy within the government as a whole that says, gee, we'd love to have that information. The prosecutors out in Dubuque really want it, but I don't want to put my name to this. I'm going to get pilloried in the press if this ever comes out. Is this really worth it? And there are times when criminal investigations die at that point because the government says, well, it's not worth it. I don't want to pay the political price for it. And maybe that's the way it should be, but that is the dynamic that occurs.
That's a good start at rebuttal. Lee, I wanted to ask if you wanted to rebut something that Lillian said, and she questions the validity of the information that some sources have, and I wondered if you could rebut that and talk about it in the context of the Hatfield investigation, if you can, because you might think in the case of the Hatfield investigation, the leak that spawned the investigation, if I understand it correctly, was somebody in the government telling the press Hatfield's a suspect and that damaged his reputation or something. So should it be okay for somebody in the government to leak information that damages someone's reputation and then have a reporter protect that inappropriate leak from investigation? Is there a value in that?
Sure. I should start by saying that I've been a huge admirer of Professor Bevere for many years. I've read much of what she's written and extremely impressed by it. But to paraphrase Chief Justice Rehnquist in Liberty Lobby versus Anderson, her remarks today read much like a lecture about cooking by someone who has never cooked before and has no intention of starting now. As a practical matter, as I say, I spend 75% of my time now representing journalists who have been subpoenaed to reveal the identity of their confidential sources. And one of the things that you've all read in the press has happened in the last few years as this has picked up steam is that journalists have been asked and in some cases required by judges to go back to their sources and try to get waivers, try to get the source to say, I release you from my pledge of confidentiality so that you don't have to risk going to jail and getting fined. And I've been involved in a number of incidents where my clients have gone back to their sources to ask for waivers from everybody from low-level Justice Department and FBI employees who had a confidential source relationship to cabinet secretaries and other high officials in government. And I have heard the byplay about you cannot reveal my name. My career will be in jeopardy. My job will be in jeopardy. My livelihood will be in jeopardy. You must keep the promise. And yes, I recognize at the end of the day, you may have to go to jail to protect me, but that's the bargain we struck. That happens all the time. And the notion that there is not going to be at least a material amount of drying up of information that the public now receives because of this recent change in the dynamics of the game, with all due respect, I think is fanciful. And I think to some extent Professor Brevere is raising a false dichotomy. She's saying all these years the press has never had a privilege and we've done just fine. Now all of a sudden we hear that everything's going to dry up if we don't have a privilege. Well, the fact of the matter is, as a practical matter, over the last 35 years, we have had a privilege. There is a decades of judicial decisions before about 5 years ago saying that there was a qualified privilege residing either in the First Amendment or the common law. And to the extent that journalists were subpoenaed at all, we usually won. I'll agree with Drew that as a practical matter, up until recently, that has meant that the Justice Department has rarely approved subpoenas for journalists. And when they have, they've been worked out in a way that was satisfactory to both sides. Part of what's gotten us in the difficulty we're in today is that many of the more celebrated of these subpoenas have been issued not by Justice Department prosecutors who are bound by the guidelines, but by independent counsel and special prosecutors who are not. I have the greatest respect for Pat Fitzgerald, who I dealt with on a number of issues in the Plame investigation, but, you know, Pat says with a straight face that he followed the DOJ guidelines, which means he said to himself, is this subpoena reasonable? Oh, yes, Pat, it's very reasonable. Go ahead and do it. On the Hatfield point, I think the facts of the Hatfield case are widely misunderstood. In the Hatfield case, and I'll use Tony Losi, who is not my, I have a client in that case who is facing a contempt application. Tony Losi is not my client, but let's be clear about what Tony Losi's been held in contempt for. Attorney General of the United States, John Ashcroft, went before television cameras in the summer of 2002 and in response to questions on the record said that Stephen Hatfield was a person of interest in the anthrax investigation who the government was looking at carefully. After that, or right before that, a search of his home was televised with, you know, helicopters swirling. And we can all accept as a premise that that's a horrible thing for somebody who hasn't been charged or indicted or anything. A year later, Dr. Hatfield is out there telling anybody who will listen that the government is focusing virtually exclusively on him, that they've placed him under 24-hour surveillance, that they've ruined his life, that the real perpetrator of the anthrax attacks is still out there somewhere, and instead, to save face, the FBI and the Justice Department is focused exclusively on him. Tony Losi writes stories that report Hatfield's version of the facts, goes to the Justice Department to say, is it true that you're focusing exclusively on this guy? Off the record, people in the Justice Department, the FBI, say, yeah, he is right about that. We are focusing exclusively on him because we think that, you know, there's a high likelihood that he did it. So she writes the stories, and if you go back and read the stories, they are highly critical of the Justice Department, the FBI, for focusing on him, but include that information in it. Hatfield brings a lawsuit under the Privacy Act claiming that those, quote, disclosures of information by the government officials violates his rights under the Privacy Act because that information must be contained in a system of records maintained by the federal government. I would argue to you that there's a good argument to be made that those people who were our sources were whistleblowers who were saying, yes, these claims that Hatfield are making are accurate. And that even if reasonable people could differ about that, as Eric says, we ought to be erring on the side of letting that information out in the context of what by that time had become a highly publicized and contentious discussion of whether or not the FBI was doing its job in trying to figure out who the heck did this attack. And we're sitting here today, and we still haven't apprehended, indicted, or convicted anybody for that crime.
There's a microphone over here, unless people can hear. Try it and see.
I can speak pretty loud, so. Questions are particularly good. This is Levine and this is Mr. Jackie O'Neill. I can't quite remember, sorry. Both of you focus very much on the idea that people's behavior will change if they don't have an ironclad guarantee of anonymity. And in particular, Mr. Levine said that it is therefore implicit in the First Amendment that that anonymity be protected. My question is, well, short form is, isn't that the idea? And the longer form is thinking about what the generation of founders thought about anonymity versus publicity when they were writing the First Amendment. It seems to me that the founders had a very keen respect for the way publicity changes people's behavior, and that in fact the emphasis on openness, on having your name attached to what you are saying, is an important corrective. Once you've said the government can't come in and say you're saying a bad thing, you're going to jail, then the importance of the
I do think it would change people's behavior, as you pointed out. I think that's exactly the idea, that it would change their behavior. I don't think we're talking about ironclad versus not ironclad guarantees. I'm sure it's a sliding scale based on the confidence they have in the likelihood of remaining anonymous. I guess where I get off the train from your sort of envisioning of this issue is I don't have a problem with people being outed for their speech. So somebody gets on a blog and says, I think, you know, the Volokh conspiracy is terrible. And the Volokh conspiracy gets together, figures out who it is, and outs the guy and says, just a disgruntled competitor. I'm good with that. What I have a problem with is the government doing it. Because the government has interests that I don't trust. Much like I think the framers didn't trust them. So I agree with this notion of social pressure as far as it goes. I agree with people having counter speech, including counter speech that says, look at how biased this guy is, or look at how biased this anonymous person is, what a coward. They won't reveal their name. I'm good with all of that. I don't think anonymity for its own sake is the point. I think anonymity as an inducement to get people to speak up at all when they otherwise wouldn't is the point. Plus, I don't want to give the government the tool to take information and use it as a club, which I fear, and with some, I think, empirical evidence, they would do. So should the public be able to treat you like dirt because you spoke anonymously? Sure, I'm good with that. So that's my short answer, is that I fear the government more than I fear the biasing effects of anonymity and the inclination of people to sort of say things that are false or misleading when they're anonymous that they wouldn't say when they're speaking publicly. But it's the flip side of the same coin, that they won't say controversial things that they think are true precisely because they fear the reaction, particularly the reaction from a government that has a whole lot more resources at its disposal than mere social disapprobation.
We go to the
rebuttal. On to that, that really is the essence. If you go and read Alexander Bickel's book, The Morality of Consent, where he has a whole chapter on this whole confidential source issue, because he represented the New York Times in the Brandsburg case itself, it's an unruly contest. Nobody's saying that the government can't use methods within its disposal internally to investigate leaks and find out who leakers are and punish them. But there's this tension, healthy tension built into the process, that we draw the line at the government going to the press or going to the person who's the vehicle for the dissemination of that person's view to find out who the anonymous speaker is. I agree with Eric that if we get more speech at the end of the day because someone else finds out who the source is, and it doesn't have any impact on the ability of the source to trust the journalist or the conduit through which its views and information are disseminated, as he said, I'm good with that too.
I just want to make one comment with respect to something that Eric said, which is that he's good with counter speech. So you get the information out there, and then you find out who it is, and you out them. One of the difficulties I have with that argument, in fact, it's the principal difficulty I have with that argument, is that when we're talking about the disclosure by a government employee who has received information under a promise of confidentiality, information that is classified pursuant to a legitimate system, which doesn't always work to do it right, I understand that, but nevertheless is a validly enacted system, and that information, the classified information, is disclosed. The damage has been done to whatever interest the government was trying to protect by that classification, and counter speech is of no use whatsoever. So it's, of course, counter speech is wonderful and important, but there are certain, you can't say that that is the always the answer to the need for the government sometimes to identify and to restrain, if you will, indeed to deter confidential sources from disclosing information that is indeed supposedly protected. Now, I also just want to say one more thing. When I think about the Reporter's Shield law, I'm really thinking about a particular kind of situation. I think in the mine run of cases, sources are, despite what Lee is suggesting, and he's right, I'm not a journalist and I haven't worked in the executive branch and I've never represented a client, but that doesn't mean I can't have views. So, and I can taste a good sauce when I eat one. The mine run of these, of the confidential sources and the anonymous sources is not, do not give their information in context in which litigation or grand jury subpoenas or prosecution is a likely, down the road scenario. It's basically in the just the everyday, process of reporting on the government. And those kinds of sources, I would suggest, are very unlikely to be threatened by the absence of a privilege, and even threatened by this run of litigation that has not enforced a privilege in favor of journalists. Because in many respects, the relationship with journalists and their sources seems to be a symbiotic one. The sources need the journalists as much as the journalists need the sources. So that I just don't feel quite the threat to my ability to find out what's going on in the government via anonymous sources that Lee claims I should.
The special case of classified information has been raised, and I think it's important to recognize as a practical matter that there are laws against the dissemination of classified information. And if we want to enforce those laws, it becomes very difficult with an absolute shield for journalists. It's just, it can be done. Government can get lucky, although there are very few things in the area of government internal investigations, criminal investigations, more difficult than doing a leak investigation. But sometimes the government does get lucky and gets from its own resources evidence on a leak investigation. But the tough thing is there's somebody who obviously has the information. I mean, the dissemination of classified information is an unusual kind of crime in that when you're talking about journalists' activities and journalists' shield, it's not just evidence about a crime or about a criminal investigation that's been disclosed. It's the actus reus. I mean, the disclosure to the journalists is in fact the crime, or at least part of the crime. And so if we're going to have that legislation, we have to be comfortable as a society. That's where we want to strike the balance. We want to raise the bar that high to the prosecution of unauthorized disclosure of classified information. I mean, to take a practical case in point, if you look at the disclosure of the government was getting, special access to SWIFT transfers, the wire transfers that as part of the terrorist tracking program, that was disclosed. It was clearly before that classified information. Now maybe Lee will tell me he's been working nonstop for the last 2 years to fend off government subpoenas on that. But as far as I'm aware, I don't know of any government subpoenas. And it's my hypothesis, without any kind of inside information. My hypothesis is the government has just decided the game's not worth the candle here. We have lost that information. It's obviously out in the mainstream. We can only do more damage, reveal more sources and methods by investigating this and prosecuting it, and we'll run into a firestorm from the press, and we just don't have the political will to do that.
Eric, and then
one quick comment on classified information issues. I'm looking at the bills, and there's a big old exception for classified information. Now, I understand that there's a hurdle that one has to overcome in order to get the source of a classified leak, that you have to, at least in the Senate version, show that there's a significant, clear, articulable harm to national security, for example.
There's no exception for retrospective.
You have to be preventing some harm from occurring.
Well, that's not
if it already happened, I'm supposed to be neutral.
Well, there are different versions of this.
This version at least suggested in a criminal investigation or prosecution, which suggests to me that it would be retrospective. A prosecution for leaking classified information. I don't know, but if that was the rule, I'd agree with it. Even if it's not the rule, that seems like a perfectly sensible rule to me. Yes, you should be able to prosecute people who leak classified information. Let's just be clear about that. But does the government get to wave and say, we think there was a leak of classified information that's important, we should get everybody's source? No. They should have to come in and say, here's what the harm was, here's why we need it. You know, because the bias, once again, is to classify everything. Let's classify that if it's embarrassing. Let's classify that if it makes us look stupid. Of course they want to classify stuff. I just don't trust the system. And this is one, albeit minor, check on the classification process. I can't count the number of times that something gets declassified and you're sitting there scratching your head wondering how it got classified in the first place. And this is a check to that. But if it turns out they're giving away where the nukes are stored, yeah, we're going to prosecute those guys, and the public is going to thank you for it. They're not going to pillory you for it. And the reporter's going to have to give it up. And that'll be that. So I don't see it as a problem.
Take another question from the floor if there's something back there.
One of the topics that is sort of missing from this discussion is an area that I've done a fair amount of work on. On our personal information, on businesses and their proprietary and their trade secrets. And I know the U.S. Chamber and National Association of Manufacturers are very engaged in trying to talk to Congress to figure out sort of the right balance here, similar to where the line is drawn between, say, whistleblowing and all the other types of proprietary information that's not whistleblowing, and making sure that continues to be able to get protection. If you look at, so there have been trade secret cases where courts have said, well, the media shield protects the leaking of trade secrets. There have been medical records cases where the media shield would protect the leaking of someone's personal medical records from their doctor's office or from a hospital. There is currently a case before the Pennsylvania Supreme Court where somebody knowingly, willfully defamed somebody in the public eye, gave false information under the cloak of an anonymous source, and there's no crime fraud exception in Pennsylvania statute. So someone can knowingly, willfully use this law as to intentionally engage in criminal or unlawful activity and yet fully know that they're 99.9% chance not going to be identified, not going to be held accountable for their unlawful behavior. And when you take out the government component of this, what this looks like is the media saying, hey, we want to protect our trade secrets or secrets of our trade or our sensitive business information for the sole purpose of being able to expose your sensitive information, your personal records, your trade secrets. And I guess what I want to ask is, why should that be? Why should the media be able to protect its trade secrets, so to speak, solely for the purpose of being able to expose all of our information and all of our legitimately proprietary information? I'm not talking about whistleblowing. I'm not talking about, you know, Enron. I'm talking about run-of-the-mill personal information. We see, the VA loses people's medical records in a database, and that could pop up on a website someplace, and then the person who gave that information gets protected.
One, the statutory privilege is in the Senate version of the bill is not absolute, especially in civil cases, which is largely what you're talking about, is not absolute. There is a showing that a party seeking the identity could make, and in situations where the private interest clearly outweighed, like you're positing, clearly outweighed what, as you're describing it, is a negligible public interest in the disclosure of the information, the privilege wouldn't apply. Second,
the bill currently reads that the purpose of getting through the privilege is to verify the accuracy of the information that was published. And so the purpose would have to be to verify the accuracy of the trade secret, to verify the accuracy of the medical record. That's what the bill says.
No.
It does, sir. And the second part of that is...
There is a provision in the bill that says... To the extent possible, that's not even in the current version of the Senate bill. I know what language you're referring to, but it doesn't apply in the context of a civil litigation where you're seeking the identity of a confidential source because it's essential to your ability to maintain your cause of action. You can't get it from alternative sources, and the public interest in the reporting of that information or the dissemination of that information was negligible. Second, this statute only applies to cases governed by federal law. It doesn't apply to state statutes protecting trade secrets. It doesn't apply to state defamation laws. They operate under whatever system of state law privileges existed beforehand and will continue to exist afterwards. So I think your concerns about those issues are really not raised by the statute.
In many of the situations you hypothesize, I don't think there's a significant First Amendment interest at all, with the possible exception of public figures. But the trade secret stuff seems to be a pretty slam dunk case for getting the information and prosecuting the person who revealed the trade secret, or suing the person who revealed the trade secret, depending on the context. As I read the Senate version, you're allowed to investigate into the circumstances surrounding the information, not merely the information itself. And presumably that's there to sort of say, well, if it was somebody with a duty not to disclose, that's one of the critical circumstances surrounding the disclosure of some otherwise significant piece of information, you'd be able to get that. Much like I said in the classified information context, if you violate a law by the very act of disclosure, then they're going to be able to get that. They just need to make a little showing that they need to get that, which presumably satisfies your concerns. I don't think we disagree on a lot of those concerns. But as for the issue of whether this is the media's trade secrets, it's not. There's no trade secret protection for your source. There's just protection against government compulsion, which I think I said before, I find very different. If somebody else finds it out and blabs it to the world, if one of your own colleagues blabs who your source was, there's no protection for that. No one gets punished for that. It's not a trade secret protection in that sense, and hence isn't really analogous.
This is a genuine question that I have, and I think it's mostly for Lee, which is, I think we both assume that in any event, the privilege is not an absolute one, right? I take it that your position is, with the qualified privilege as it presently appears in the legislation, the public interest in securing information in particular situations in which there is a genuine need for it for purposes of protecting either a law enforcement interest that is persuasive to a judge or an interest in national security or something like that. The public interest is adequately protected by a qualified privilege. What I don't get is why a qualified privilege is enough for the journalists who claim that they're going to dry up if they don't have a privilege. I mean, it seems to me that the privilege from the point of view of the arguments in favor of it has got to be absolute or it's not going to work because we know that if it's not absolute, there are situations in which those sources who most wanted to have anonymity are not going to have anonymity protected because they're going to be the ones that are in the middle of very serious investigations about serious criminal activity, it seems to me anyway. So they're most at risk, and that risk is one that is likely to materialize. So would you explain to me why it is that this privilege is that you can accept a privilege that's less than absolute and still say that it's enough to keep the free flow of information from these anonymous sources. I don't get it.
Logically and analytically, what we're arguing for would call for an absolute privilege. And there's no question that from the perspective of journalists, an absolute privilege would be better. From their perspective, it would result in more information being provided to them, and in turn, more information being disseminated to the public. There are, however, countervailing interests on the other side, many of which have been discussed here today. As a practical matter, Congress is not going to pass a bill that has an absolute privilege. The courts have never recognized an absolute privilege under the First Amendment or the common law. So the question is the press better off with something materially better than the state of affairs today, but not as good as what it would like to have in a perfect world? And there's been great debate within the press about that. There are curmudgeons out there who say, by gum, the First Amendment is all we need, and we don't want to go to Congress hat in hand asking for legislation. Well, the contemporary interpretation of the First Amendment is that there isn't a privilege that they think they have, and that this will make things materially better than they are now. Not absolute and not as good as they would like it to be in a perfect world, but I don't think there's any question that at the end of the day, if this bill is passed, there will be more sources willing to come forward about more important things.
Couple hands. We'll try to keep the questions and the answers short in the red shirt here.
Came to the top of the debate, so if any of the other questions in the room relate specifically to this topic, I would defer. But if not,
I'm sorry.
I'm going to change the.
You're going off the media shield legislation?
No. Okay. Media shield legislation, but not having to do with the issues that have just been raised.
That's fine.
Okay. I'm concerned about an implicit part of this legislation, which is essentially, you have to establish who is and isn't a journalist. And you're setting up, in some sense, we're backing into licensing our journalists and creating two classes of citizens with different levels of First Amendment protection and potentially deprotecting those who aren't journalists. Or are we simply going to include almost everyone who has access to a computer? And therefore can post a public posting somewhere under the shield of journalists, at which point this legislation is really increasing the reach of the First Amendment. And so it seems to me that central to understanding the legislation is coming out and saying, and this is where the line is going to be drawn, and I'd like to open that to discussion.
That's a great point, and the court in Brandsburg raised the difficulty of the definitional issue, and there have been some journalist, a guy who writes for Slate, whose name I can't remember, who has opposed the legislation because of the problem that you identify. So it's a really good question.
Who wants to, Eric, you want to?
I sort of make choice two. Everyone's journalists, if they're willing to speak out publicly on blogs, I mean, anybody with a computer pretty much can be a journalist. As I read the Senate version, you have to engage in the gathering, preparing, collecting, photographing, recording, writing of newsworthy matters regularly, whatever that means. I think the House version doesn't require that it be a regular activity. But I give it all because I don't view the press as a separate entity than the public. I merely view the press as a vehicle for broad dissemination of speech. It's not a sort of discrete fourth estate, if you will. It's just a means of putting out regular ordinary speech in written form or electronic form. So that's not a problem from my perspective. I'd let everyone do this. Why not?
I was just going to say, I think that's where the Congress is sort of between a rock and a hard place, because I think this legislation, in providing a shield for confidential sources to journalists, got to make precisely the choice that you suggest, which is everyone or just journalists. And if we decide that the press performs this particular function that no one else in the society can perform, and that they do have an institutional role to play, and that they are the agent of the public for the public's right to know, and so forth, which captures part of their argument, then you are having two classes of citizens, and you are having, as you suggest, you're down the road to, you get a license. You don't just get a press pass. You don't just get to ride on the plane occasionally, but you're a special class entitled to special privileges. So part of the problem in Brownsburg was the court was concerned about the press claiming privileges that ordinary citizens don't have. We can either do that, or we can say an ordinary citizen should have the same privilege that the press is now claiming to not respond to grand jury subpoenas and to not reveal what they are asked to reveal in the course of legitimate criminal investigations. To my mind, that really goes pretty far. So I think you put your finger on a real practical aspect of this bill that is a problem. You've got to do it. I think you have to make one or the other choices.
In my view, I understand the theoretical problem. As a practical matter, I am confident it is not a problem. In the 30 years of case law development that we had under the First Amendment-based privilege, courts, it will not surprise you, from time to time were confronted with claims of reporters' privilege by people who were not employed by the New York Times or the Washington Post, and they had to decide, is this person entitled to invoke the privilege? And many courts came up with a test that quite sensibly looked to the intent of the person at the time that they were gathering the information that, and thereby made the promise of confidentiality. So if their intent was to gather the information for the purpose of disseminating it to the public, the courts held, yes, you're a journalist, even though you don't have a press pass and you don't work for the New York Times. If you weren't, if you were Klaus von Bülow's girlfriend and you were sitting in the gallery at his trial taking notes, and after the fact said, oh, I was thinking about maybe writing a book, you're not, and you don't have a privilege. And the current version of the Senate bill incorporates that intent standard. This bill doesn't protect the press. It doesn't purport to identify who the press is. It protects anybody who is engaging in the act of journalism, whether they're employed by a news organization or a blogger sitting in their proverbial kitchen table in their pajamas.
Right. The current draft is in the
That's out now?
Yeah.
All right, well. I think as a practical matter, what would happen is you get a spectrum of decisions if that were the law. And then some judges would call it one way, some judges would call it another. You would, if you're not a guy with a press card in his hat working for mainstream media, then it's unclear. It would depend on perhaps what the judge ate for breakfast that day.
The only thing I want to say is that this is not a generic privilege against testifying in all circumstances. It has to be testimony somehow related to information that you did disclose or were about to disclose or were planning on disclosing. So, I mean, it's not that we're giving the public the right to blow the courts off whenever they get hauled into court. It's just we're preserving an information gathering and dissemination function with the critical element being the intent to disseminate at some point.
Right here, Bill.
There are two parts to it, but it's short. The central argument in favor of the privilege is that without it, the public is going to be deprived of important news stories. I just wonder about the factual support for that claim. Can either of you name a story? Not in the present day. Obviously, would be quite difficult to know what you don't know. So you can't know about a story that hasn't come out. But certainly over the last 20 30, 40, 50 years, there would be revelations of an important public story that was not investigated or published for the want of this privilege. What is that story? I've never heard of it. What is the factual support for the claim that news is not going to be investigated or published without this privilege? And I think if the answer to that is, as I suspect, that there's not a whole lot about, although I'm certainly willing, you know, to listen to the answer. I think it's because the actual incentives to members of the press have been misassumed and mischaracterized. That is, what is ordinarily said about it is that, well, you know, these reporters are going to go to jail. They'll be, you know, in for civil contempt for 30, 60, 90 days. And that's true as far as it goes, but it doesn't go far enough because after they get out of jail, they become martyrs and heroes. They go on the lecture circuit for $10,000 a pop. They go on Larry King Live, and they become lionized by all their colleagues for the rest of their careers. So I think the actual set of incentives kind of that lie behind this claim for the privilege is very different from what it's being portrayed.
Well, you talk about any historical stuff, I would just point out two flaws in the question. One is, of course, how would you know what didn't get reported if it, by definition, didn't get reported? And two, the tail end of your point seems to be that contempt is an ineffective deterrent, so we will have confidentiality anyway. Then I'm sort of wondering why in the world we're holding them in contempt in the first place. Either we assume that the penalty encourages disclosure or we don't. There are plenty of reporters who presumably cave during negotiations out of fear of being thrown in jail because they are not the top-tier reporters who are going to be lionized, but they're the second-tier reporters who will be forgotten in the bowels of the lockup for months or whatever it is. But to indirectly answer your question, I don't know one way or the other about stories that weren't reported. What I do know is what happens when anonymity is denied in the campaign finance context. And I've had plenty of instances with prospective clients or contributors to prospective clients saying, we will not contribute if you are going to have to put our name down on a federal disclosure requirement. So I think there's a fair inference from what we do know that publicity deters certain people from engaging in certain types of speech or association, that general principle seemingly would apply to news stories and sources for people who would be fired when it got out that they leaked that the DOJ or DOL was doing something unsavory.
It's documented in my own testimony in both the House and the Senate in support of the Shield Law. About 3 years ago, the Cleveland Plain Dealer had a story, we still don't know what it was about, in which they were leaked confidential documents they shouldn't have had by a confidential source, about a story that the editor, a guy named Doug Clifton, felt was clearly a matter of public concern that his readers deserved and would benefit from knowing about. He specifically decided not to run the story because he thought that it would inevitably lead to subpoenas and the need for his journalists to keep their promises of confidentiality to their sources. And he wrote a column about it explaining that he wasn't going to publish that story. As for your point about journalists becoming martyrs and heroes, I would agree with you. Back in the day when this rarely, if ever, happened, that was the perception. Journalists, to some extent, thought it wouldn't be such a bad thing as a career move. I can tell you that that is not the case today. If you would like to ask Judy Miller how her involvement in the Plain case helped her career, I think she'll tell you that it was not a very good thing. She is no longer employed by the New York Times and is not doing lectures for $10,000 a day.
2 minutes till two. Did you want to make one quick point?
Well, I don't know. This might be sort of too cheap of a shot, but one of the things that occurred to me as Lee was speaking about the last few years, all these subpoenas to journalists, it's conceivable. I realize it's a devastating thought that the reason for the subpoenas is that journalists have begun to breach some norms of the kinds of information they would disclose and the circumstances in which they would disclose it that were, in fact, unwritten laws. And so they've sort of gone over a line that has required prosecutors then to go over the unwritten line that was there in the sand protecting them from one another. I'm gonna stop now.
I didn't mean to let Lillian have the last word on that, but we're at our time. So thank you all for coming.